It's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown. It's been a beautiful, beautiful last week of summer, especially for those of us who don't have to work, you know, which I don't, being retired and everything. And it heightens the pleasure to see other people working so hard, which you do. You see tractor headlights out there in the dark, bumping over the fields, going back and forth, picking corn and combining soybeans, trucks rolling up to the farmers' co-op down by the railroad tracks, down there by the big elevators, the big concrete silos that, to a writer like me, resemble a Greek temple, but not to the guy driving the truck. It's just an elevator. That's all it is. I majored in English, you see, and my only job really is to describe and to compare one thing to another, which is easy work because I am the only writer in this town that I come from, you see. I mean, farming is a competitive enterprise, and any farmer who drives by the farm of another farmer and slows down forms an opinion about that farm, a critical opinion, which he'd be glad to share with somebody, not that farmer, but anybody else. So you are surrounded by criticism, whereas my teachers in Lake Wobegon were delighted just to see me put pencil to paper, just see me put sentences and paragraphs down. It was like growing up in some remote African village where people consider you a basketball star if you can dribble. I never wrote about corn picking, of course, because other people knew so much more than I did about it. I wrote about romance and dreaminess because to the Norwegians around me, this was exotic. This was something they did not have direct experience of. And there are not many great stories about combining anyway. I mean, there were a few gruesome ones. There was a man in our town who came over late at night to help his neighbor who was combining, and the combine had broken down, and he came over and he fixed the combine, and he yelled to the neighbor who was at the controls, said, "Try it now," and the neighbor started it up, and the wrench that he had left inside the discharge chute was flung out by the propeller, and it killed him right there on the spot. This good Samaritan was killed by the wrench that he had used to fix this combine, which ran very well from then on. I mean, nobody wants to hear that story. I mean, what does it lead to? Don't talk about rope to a man whose brother has been hanged, you know. So I wrote about being in love, and I had a few good experiences with it, you know, before I got in over my head. But we don't need to talk about that, do we? I came to this fair when I was 14 years old, and I came with a girl I was in love with, although I had not found a way to tell her this, because what if she did not like me? And I thought she did, because sometimes she laughed at things that I said, but laughter and love are not interchangeable. We know this. And we had not gotten even to the hand-holding stage yet. We were naive back in the day. We moved so slowly. I felt it was the girl's responsibility to initiate hand-holding, but I also felt that it's not something you should ever have to discuss with somebody. You know, you just reach over and do it. But it was a big enough thrill for me just to brush up against her, just brush elbows or shoulders. I was 14, and so was she. She was very smart. Her name was Corinne. She was the only Corinne in our school. There were dozens of Karens, only one Corinne. Her dad was a plumber. She was planning to go to Carleton College, so she was in a different league from me. My plan was to graduate from high school and get a job in the post office and to become a writer like Hemingway. And Hemingway had never gone to college, so I figured I would not need to either. He hadn't worked in the post office, but, you know, I could worry about that later. I worried a little bit that I did not have the experiences that a novelist ought to have, such as holding a girl in my arms and kissing her passionately. I had practiced holding pillows in my arms and kissing them, but it's hard to do that passionately and really believe in it. And I wanted to do this with a living human being. I mean, anybody would, right? And namely her. She was right there. She was very smart. She was lovely. She was an only child, which seemed ideal to me. I was the middle child of six. She was the only child. Her parents had drinks before dinner, and they smoked cigarettes. I came from Sanctified Brethren, and they did not. They were something else. I don't know what they were. They never talked about it. They had an enormous aquarium in their living room. It sat on top of the piano. And when her mother played On the Road to Mandalay, the fish got enormously excited, and they seemed to be on very serious dates with each other. And we sang, and that made them even more excited. It was her dad's favorite song, On the Road to Mandalay, and also It's You from Music Man and Sentimental Journey. And Corinne played the piano, and her parents danced, and it was very dreamy. My family preferred songs like Leaning on the Everlasting Arms and Trust and Obey, for There's No Other Way to Be Happy in Jesus But to Trust and Obey, which you cannot really dance to. Not that I've ever tried, but we did not dance. Dancing was wrong because it aroused carnal impulses, which in my case were awake and dressed and waiting for the bus to come, but what could you do? We came down to the fair, and we came down with her dad, who was driving his white Cadillac, and we parked in the lot on the north end of the fair, which is up behind the grandstand here, and he was going to ride his motorcycle in a parade with the motorcycle unit of the Zura Shrine Temple in Minneapolis. And his motorcycle had Arabic symbols on it, a star and crescent and a camel. And his outfit was hanging on hangers in the back seat of the Cadillac. I sat in the back seat, Corinne sat in the front seat, and I looked at this costume. There were pantaloons and a sort of burnoose. And I'm not sure you would wear this today, but back then it was considered innocent. And a big billowy silk shirt that was yellow and gold. And he had a scarlet fez with a tassel on it, which he had in a hat box right there. Corinne sat in the front seat, and I sat behind her. And I looked at the back of her neck and her short black hair all the way to the fairgrounds, just looking at it. We came in through the Larpinder Avenue entrance and parked in this grassy lot where the other Shriners had parked. The motorcycle was on a trailer pulled by the Cadillac, and he asked me to direct him as he was backing into a spot. So I got out and I waved to him to back up, and he did, and he backed the trailer right over my left foot. It was in the wrong place, I guess, and it was soft ground back there, so it didn't hurt terribly, but I couldn't move with this trailer tire on my foot, and I didn't know what to do, how to express this. I did not want to be a problem, you know? I tried to pull my foot out, but the tire was heavy and was right there on top of it. The weight of the motorcycle was there. And he yelled, "How's that?" And I said, "Just come back a few feet." He said, "Why?" Well, as I look back on it, that would have been the time to say something. You know, your trailer tire is on my foot. But it seemed like a dumb thing to say. And also it seemed like an accusation. And I was in love with her. I said, "Could you pull forward a little bit then?" He said, "It looks good to me." I just wasn't sure how to put it. And by now, there's an interval of time when a tire is on your foot, when you should say something. And if you don't, it's a missed opportunity. I don't know. I hope it never happens to you, but anyway, Corinne got out of the car, and she came back, and I told her that the tire was, and it obviously was, on my foot there. And she yelled at her dad, "You backed over his foot," she said. And he came out to see if this was so, and it was. And there it was. And he said, "Why didn't you say something?" Well, I didn't want to be a problem, you know. I figured it would just come out of its own accord or something. And so he pulled forward, and that really hurt. He pulled forward, and I could feel something crunch, and I took a step, and it hurt. But I helped him open the gate, and he got the motorcycle down off the trailer, and then he went in the back seat to change into his pantaloons and into the vest and the burnoose and the fez, which took him a little bit. She said, "What would you like to do at the fair?" "All sorts of things. Things I couldn't even describe. I didn't even know what they were." I said, "I don't know, we could walk around a little bit." She said, "Does your foot hurt?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'm so sorry." And she took my hand and she held it. I remember this so clearly. I don't remember much more of what happened that whole year, but I remember her holding my hand, and I remember her putting an arm around me. And she said, "Let's find someplace shady to go sit." And we went over to the horticulture building, and we sat on a bench. And there on this great stage in the middle, there was a whole band coming in, Wally Olson and his band, and Bert Hansen, the tenor, from WCCO 830, The Good Neighbor to the Great Northwest, a show called Good Neighbor Time, and Bob DeHaven and Joyce Lamont and Cedric Adams, all three of them walked in, the most famous people in the whole Midwest. We knew them by voice, and they looked exactly as we hoped they would. They were beautiful and beautifully dressed. We did not stare at them. We treated them like royalty. We didn't ask them for autographs. We did not try to take pictures of them with our telephones, because we had left our telephones at home, you know, where they were wired into the wall. We watched them ascend the stage, and we sat and we talked. She was very smart, and she had read Karl Marx, she had read Das Kapital, and she had read the Communist Manifesto, and she liked it. She liked it. She liked the idea of the means of production being in the hands of the workers, and she liked the saying of Marx. He said in this book, "We will hang the last capitalist we will hang is the one who sold us the rope." She just kept repeating that. I don't know. I didn't know what it meant, but, you know, I was only bound for the post office, and she was going to Carleton College. We sat there and we watched the show, and she offered me a cigarette, and I took it, and then I looked around and I saw my Uncle Earl and Aunt Myrna sitting just around the other side, and so I put it in my pocket and I saved it for later. I don't remember a lot of what happened that day, except that I remember that we got on the double Ferris wheel, which was right out there on the midway, and we sat in it, and one wheel spun as the whole axis turned and turned, and you made figure eights up in the dark. She put her arm around me and she turned toward me, and we could have kissed if we wanted to, and then we did, because we were too close not to. And so she kissed me on the Ferris wheel, and she took my hand in hers, and she put it over her heart, and I could feel her heart beating. We had a long drive home. Up in the parking lot, Shriners in their Arabic outfits were sitting around a campfire, and they were drinking beer, and they were singing some sort of Arabic songs. And so we walked around in the dark, Corinne and I, and then we got in the back seat, both of us, as her dad, who had had a few beers, drove home. He was very, very happy. We sang On the road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play, and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China Cross. We sang it at the tops of our voices as we drove north towards Lake Wobegon. I remember a diesel truck coming by us, and its horn like a saxophone blowing in the dark. He was a little bit drunk, and he was kind of all over the road, and she and I were sitting in the back seat and holding hands, and then we turned and we kissed again, and I opened my mouth to say something, and I felt her tongue inside my mouth. We kissed long and beautifully. She said, "I love you," and I tried to say something, but I couldn't think of anything poetic enough to say. On we went. We drove home, waving back and forth on the road and singing songs that we knew. It's you in the sunrise. It's you in my cup. It's you all the way into town. And it was her. It was her. It was her. And right over there at the horticulture building, right over there and over there where the double Ferris wheel was, there are whole decades of my life that are just a blur. I don't remember them, but I remember her. I remember over there, and I remember over there. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, all the children are above average.